if you find value in yourself, others will see that as well. And that doesn't just correlate to sales. It's value in your words and knowing what you're speaking is truth. And when you're presenting or sharing information to other people or educating them in, whether it be the field or in life, if you don't believe in yourself, they're not going to.
Hello and welcome to our podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information, not mere facts, to an audience of future leaders around the globe. In other words, we will be talking to interesting people about their interesting experiences. My name is Siebe van der Zee, and I'm your host. I'm originally from the Netherlands and currently living in the state of Arizona in the United States, also known as the Dutchman in the desert. My company is involved in executive search and performance coaching. And oh yeah, in my career, I've had the opportunity to live in 4 countries on 3 continents. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF, and PDF helps up-and-coming professionals accelerate their performance in the modern workplace. I hope you will enjoy this program. Our guest today is Jacob Butler. Welcome, Jacob.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Wonderful. I appreciate you're on board. Jacob is a member of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, and he is an Ankh Akimel Otham, the indigenous name of his people. He has lived within the community his entire life. Jacob is an artist, and he specializes in traditional shell work, ranging from shell etching and carving to overlay and inlay. He is equally known as a skilled potter, practicing the paddle anvil technique, a pottery style used by his ancestors. His work can be found and has been on display in collections of local museums, national monuments, the Smithsonian, and private collections around the world. Jacob is also the community gardens coordinator for the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, a position he has held for the past 17 years. During this time, he has worked with many indigenous communities across the country. Jacob has served on many boards related to the arts and culture, and currently, Jacob is the chair for the nonprofit Native Seed Search Board of Directors. Wow. And I have to mention that, of course, we are both living in Arizona. And as we both know, Phoenix, Arizona is known as the fastest growing city in the United States, the 5th largest city in the United States, but only over the last more or less 150 years, because your ancestors have been here for thousands of years. And it was remarkable in history that around 1870 or so, when the first settlers came out here, they found very massive irrigation canals that indicated that indeed people used to live here. And that is related to the name Phoenix, the mythical bird risen from the ashes. But truly, your ancestors have been here for hundreds, thousands of years, right?
Yeah, we like to say time immemorial, and our creation stories say that we come from here. And so so as far back as anybody can remember, we've always been here. We're of this earth, or we're indigenous to the land, you know. And when those settlers came, they saw these ancient sites and they said, you know, people used to live here. Well, that's not exactly true. We still do live here. We've never left. But just like any other living culture, those cultures evolve or regress and they become something else. So no living culture stays the same. And so when they seen the autumn of today or of that time, they didn't reflect the way that those sites looked, those ancient ruins. And so they said just that these people once lived here. And so we like to say that we're still here, we've never left, but that's how Phoenix got its name, is because basically the entirety of Phoenix is built upon the ancestral home sites of our people. And so they gave it the name Phoenix, like the mythical bird rising from the ashes. And so it's fitting, but at the same time, we'd like to make that correction to say that we are those same people. The only culture or the only our tribe or people that are able to stay the same or dead societies. Archaeology likes to put starts and ends to things. And so what that really says is from this period to this period, we lived a certain lifestyle that remained pretty much the same. And so when you refer to our ancestors as the Ho'okam, they're speaking to only a short section in time in the timeline of our ancestry. And so, yeah, I just wanted to make that statement.
No, I think it's a very important point. And I look at it that indeed at the origin of the fastest growing city in the United States, there is your community. And that is very powerful in itself, again, because of the very long history and, of course, the cultural aspects of your community. I look forward to discussing the 10 lessons that you have learned. And I have to assume that it wasn't necessarily learned over 50 years, correct?
Well, I would say no. But the lifestyle and the standard of living, like the life expectancy for my people, is a little lower. And usually that's true on reservations across the country. And so I think we live a little faster life, and we become grandparents a little sooner. And so some of the things that took some people maybe 50 years to learn, I've learned a little faster, but I still have a lot of things to learn, and I'm still trying to struggle with some of these things that that my parents have taught me over the years.
That's very interesting. And perhaps before we get into the 10 lessons that you provided, is there, you know, any particular lesson that you have learned that you say that really stands out, or that is really perhaps the most important lesson that you have learned?
Yeah. So the way we say our way of life in Otham is our Himadak. So our Himadak is our way of life. It's the underlying belief system that's expressed in all cultural aspects. But it's how we live our life, how we interact with one another. And one of the main things is to be selfless, you know, and to treat others, you know, just like the Bible would say, treat others as you would expect to be treated, right? And when people come over, it doesn't matter if we have nothing to eat, and the only piece of food we have, or even if it's water, we offer it to our guests, you know. And my dad is like the perfect example of that. Like I can remember as a kid waking up in the middle of the night, and people would come over asking for rides, needing help, needing to go to the hospital. Let me backtrack a little bit. My father was a behavioral health counselor for 25 years. And so he counseled a lot of community members with addiction. And so people would come over like 2 a.m, 3 a.m, just wanting to talk. And I can remember my dad sitting outside talking to them, giving them rides. I remember sitting in his office like well into the night, just sitting with people drinking coffee with them so that they wouldn't relapse. And I watched my dad save somebody's life on the road that was run over. Wow. I've watched him stop many times to help people in car wrecks, or help people get back on the road, change tires. And I've watched people drive down the road with his car and him not in it, you know. And so I've seen that growing up. And I think I've seen it so much that I had the opposite reaction, where I was less willing to help because I felt people took advantage of that. But my dad can go anywhere in this community and even outside of this community, and people know him and people respect him. And my father had a really good name, and is based on the principles that he lives his life. And he's truly the most selfless person that I know. And to be honest, he's one of the happiest people I know. And so I think he's more happy in the service of others. And so that's something that I'm still trying to do. I try, but I am in no way his equal in that respect.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, and obviously something that we should all adhere to, helping others and taking care of others, especially those who need it, who are in a position where they cannot take care of themselves. And it's good to take the example of your elders, of your parents, and your father in particular. That's a good lesson to learn, even if perhaps when you're young, I guess many of us tend to be a little bit more selfish. Yeah. Right?
And I definitely live that life. So, but you know, I think it's returned to you tenfold. And I think in his experience and watching him, I've seen that. I've seen people come and help him and do things for him, even when he never asks. And so it's just a good way to live your life. And I think when I was looking at the truths that you asked me to explain, I didn't realize it, but a lot of what he's taught me is, rubbed off on me. And I do find those values being expressed in the things that I do and in my life. I think it's just a shadow of how he is. And that's something that I'd strive for.
Well, that's a great point. It's a good point to start with when we look at the lessons learned. The first lesson that you provided, know your worth.
Yeah.
What comes to mind with that?
So I'll use an example, I guess, in my art. Before I start any type of new medium, and so for me, I like to move around in different art forms and work in different mediums because it keeps things fresh. And for me, the study of that art form is really what gets me excited about things. And so the work that I put into my art, it doesn't just start with me picking up a paintbrush and putting it to canvas or picking up a piece of silver and starting to manipulate it with a chasing tool. It's hours and hours of research before you even get into the actual craft. And so I would go to market, and because I felt that I was not of the degree or standard that some of these artists that were known or had names behind them and had a lot of experience, I would sell my work for a lot less. I would sell my work for a lot less, and I would downplay my own worth in the conversations that I have with the customers. And even to the point where I'd point out mistakes of my work, basically talk myself out of sales.
Bad salesperson.
Yeah. And so what I kind of learned, though, is that, a lot of people wouldn't buy my work. And I asked somebody that was really interested in my work. They were a friend of mine. And so I felt comfortable enough to ask them. And I said, you passed on my piece here. I said, but I feel that it's executed a little better than the piece that you bought down the way. And I understand that art's subjective and it touches people in different ways. And so something that may not catch your eye in my booth is going to catch your eye somewhere else. But I felt comfortable enough asking him. And he said, well, when I went to your booth, you told me all the things that was wrong with it, all the things that you messed up on. And then you sold it for next to nothing. And he said, and I really didn't want to pay for it. And he said, one, because you downplayed what it was. And he said, the other reason is you don't have value in it yourself. And to me, I'm like, I do, just putting the number on it. I was looking at it like, well, if I sell anything, I'm successful. But what he was saying is that if I don't find value in my own work to put a price on it that reflects the work that went into it, then why should I expect others to? And so it kind of resonated with me, and I sat on it for a while. And so the next market we had, I put my prices very high.
Yeah.
And I said, well, this is what I'm going to sell it for. I do have a job. I work full time as a garden coordinator. And I said, I do this on the side, but I'm going to own the work that went into it. I'm going to own the time and what it meant to me to make these things. And I'm going to put a price on it. And if it sells, then great. And if not, I'm not feeding my children with this. And so the sales that I make off of my artwork, I'm able to do things with my kids. I'm able to give them a fuller life, take them on vacation, show them things that my parents showed me, and provide for them in a little bit better way than just by getting by, And so if I sell it, great. And if not, I'll find another home for it later. And so what was interesting is I used to have collaborative booths with a friend of mine, and it was all to save money. So we would work on something together and we would put it out, and we'd only have to pay half of the price of the booth. And he said, well, you determine the cost of this. What do you want to sell it for? And I said, well, and it was a pot. It was a vessel that takes a lot of skill, and there's not very many people that make them. Mm-hmm. And we made it together, and I had painted in it, and there was over 40 hours worth of work in this vessel, and it's something that was rare. And so I said, well, I want $1,200 for this. And he got kind of upset with me, and he's more of the bread and butter, selling a bunch of things to make his living. And so he said, well, you're not going to make more than $60 on it. Pay me half, and then whatever you make on it, you can, but you're probably going to go home with it. And he was really upset. And so I said, all right, cool. And so I put it out, and before the market even started, a gentleman came up to me and said, this is very rare. What is this? And I was explaining to him, the process, and I kept in mind not to downplay my worth. And I told him, this is how it's done. This is, these are how many people still practice this. This is the history of it. And he said, well, how much are you asking? And so I only wanted $1,200. So I told him $1,500. And he said, well, I have $1,100 right now cash, and I'll pay it. He said, you can leave it at your booth and I'll come back for it later. And my friend's eyes like just got so big, and his jaw dropped to the floor. And I mean, to me, that kind of just like cemented or solidified everything that guy had told me the time before. And if you find value in yourself, others will see that as well. And that doesn't just correlate to sales. It's value in your words and knowing what you're speaking is truth. And when you're presenting or sharing information to other people or educating them in, whether it be the field or in life or in the arts, if you don't believe in yourself, they're not going to. And so
there's wisdom right there. I agree. And I see, of course, I can imagine, I'm not an artist, of course, but as an artist, it's not just the time it took to put it together. There is right, the artistic talent plus the research, as you said, that you do, but the end product, that's what stands out. And I've seen some of your artwork and it looks amazing. I see behind you some examples in the background, amazing items that you create. But I understand that humility perhaps initially will say, well, you know, let's see if somebody is interested. And then indeed, if you know your worth, then you can charge accordingly, and you find out that people are willing to pay that. That's a very interesting lesson right there. The second lesson that you come up with, it is definitely connected as well, but stand behind your principles unless they conflict with a greater value. There may have been some situations that you have dealt with where your principles were perhaps stronger than issues that you were dealing with, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I'm very stubborn and I do stand behind my principles. And so it's very hard to change my opinion sometimes because of that. But if those principles hurt or impede the way that I really live my life and the belief system that I follow, then you have to adjust them. And so what I'm trying to say is, for example, the benefit and welfare of my kids, you know, I'll do anything for my kids. That's the whole reason I get up and go to work. You know, I don't think anybody can say, even in a job they love, that they would rather be at work than with their family. So there was an instance where I had to make a choice on something that I believed in at work. And if I stood by it, I probably wouldn't have a job. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I didn't believe in that principle, but it would affect my ability to care for my kids and really in any job. I tell my wife and my kids, I don't work for my tribe. I don't work for the people. I work for them. The whole reason I get up and I function every day and I do right is because of my kids, you know, and those children, those are the greatest value to me in my life. And those are the reasons that I get up every day and do the things that I do. And so sometimes you have to set aside your principles for the greater good. And the things that you believe in. And so I think that if I made sense is what I was trying to say.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, Jacob. And I'm thinking also about the fact that you are a grandfather.
Yeah, I'm a grandfather. I would say a little earlier than I wanted to be, but
no choice. But we're here you are.
And they're definitely blessings.
The third lesson that you list is engage the world. Yeah. What do you mean with that?
Well, one of the greatest things the gifts that my parents gave me was the understanding that our world doesn't end on the border of our reservation. My friends growing up had really no desire to leave this community or engage with anybody else other than our own. And to know them today, and some of them, like they've never even experienced different foods. You know, my mom and dad taught me proper etiquette through so I know how to use my napkins. I know which fork to use and all that things, you know? And so we would take people that we work with out to eat. And these people like that we knew all our lives, like they just were so far out of their element because they've never experienced anything. They never had a desire to experience anything. But I think it's something that my parents instilled in me very, very early on. I remember going on vacation, like going to California all the time, Texas, New Mexico, Nevada, Colorado, like all the states like adjacent to us. And since then, I've traveled all over the country, and my kids are just talking to me about all the places that I've been. I've had the opportunity to travel overseas, but the situations haven't allowed me yet. And so one of the greatest things that I regret is not being able to participate in the slow foods movement in Italy. I had a scholarship to attend a 2-week conference there in Italy a few years ago, and my job requirements kept me here. But those are things that I still strive for. And I think seeing that, it just opens the world to me. Like you like to say, celebrate those differences, but to see a lot of the commonalities that exist throughout human nature and the people, you know, like at first it's a little scary, you know, to go outside your comfort zone. But once you do, your horizons are just that much greater.
I fully agree. Absolutely. And I hope you will have a chance to travel the world in that sense, just to experience. And for most people, of course, it's not to say, well, we like that other country better than our native country. That's not what it's all about. But to experience, yeah, it just opens your mind. I think that's an important point. Lesson number four. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, before we go on really quick, yeah, I would say that too. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I enjoy traveling a lot. I enjoy seeing different things. And one of the things that I find kind of scary is seeing the same thing everywhere. So when I go to a different state, I want to see the local culture. I don't want to see the same Starbucks and McDonald's on the corner. And so I try to really immerse myself in the culture of the area. And for the longest time, I would tell my wife, you know, I would go anywhere in the world, but I'll never live anywhere else. And then I think in the recent years, I would say, you know, I would like to live here for a while. Or I would like to live here for a while. But I think I would always have a longing to come home. And I always think that my community, which is human nature, is the communities that we're born into, is where we have that nostalgia and is where our heart lies.
And that is the most common. That is the most common. If I think about people that are used to traveling, whether it's for business or on vacation, they really enjoy the traveling. But at the end of the day, let's say, to use that expression, they want to go back to the country that they came from. There are exceptions. I'm one of the exceptions. I'm the Dutchman in the desert, right? Yeah. And of course, I know other people that have moved to a different country and have adjusted. But the vast majority of people, they really believe that they should be in their native country. And with that, I think many people will say, that's the best country or community in the world. And we feel that way because that fits with our family and our customs and the food indeed as well. But I hope one day to invite you to come to the Netherlands and show you around, and we can have some good food over there. And
I would thoroughly enjoy
add it
that
to the list. That would yeah, be, that would be awesome. Invest in lasting impact. Lesson number four.
Yeah. So a lot of the things that I do, my decisions to get involved in them aren't for the profit or the personal gain. It's for the impact to not, maybe not just my community, but specifically to my kids and the world that they're going to grow up in, you know. And so with my art, I like to try to get engaged in things that are going to be here for a while. I recently just did part of a trailhead system for the Pueblo Grande Museum here in Phoenix. It's an ancient site of our people. And those interpretive panels are going to be up for at least 20 years, if not longer. And once they are retired, they're going to go into their collections. And so whether it's 20 years or 50 years from now and I'm no longer here, my children can go and request to see those things. And so those are things that I do with my art to try to give a lasting legacy for them so that they can be proud of their father and the things that I stood for. But on a greater sense, just like the work I'm doing with Native Seed Search, it wasn't something that I wanted to do. You know, it's a board position that doesn't pay you. It requires a lot of your time that you can be spending with your family or doing other things. And I didn't want to do it. And a lot of my friends kind of weren't big fans of the organization. And I would like to say right now, you know, I'm a fan of Native Seed Search. I believe what they stand for is valid. And we've seen multiple accounts of loss of seed diversity in our communities, not only throughout the Southwest, but throughout the world. Yes. And so having this organization outside of any one tribal or federal government leadership is vital, you know. And actually, we've came back to them as a tribe to get seeds that were lost here. And so one of the complaints was, well, it's an organization with the name Native in it, and there's really no Native representation there. And so I talked to some of my friends and some of the biggest opponents of the organization. I said, you know, I was approached to sit on their board, and I want to know how you would feel about that if I took it. I still would like to be your friend. And so one of the biggest opponents was like, you know, my biggest problem is that they're profiting off the sale of indigenous seeds, and there's no representation for the people. They're not talking to the people. There's no communication with the people. And so I looked into it, and that's not how it was established. It was established with those fundamental values, but for some time they had gotten away from it. And so I looked at it as an opportunity to be the change that we complain about. And I think a lot of people complain, but they don't rise to the occasion when the opportunity to make that change themselves is there. And so I got on there, and then they lost their chair because of the COVID issues that we're going through. And there's a lot of loss within tribal communities. And so they lost the chair that had recently signed on to be the chair of the executive board of directors. They resigned to handle things in their community. And so the board asked me, well, what are the things you see wrong? And so I just laid out this whole list of things that I saw wrong.
They said, you should be the chairman.
And they said, well, you sound like the perfect candidate to take that place. And so I told my wife, and she's like, you know, you already invested a lot of time in this. You're going to invest a lot more. You're an artist. You still work. When are you going to have time to spend with your kids? And I looked at it, and I said, you know, if I don't do this, then will I have the right to complain and say the things that I'm complaining about if I didn't take the opportunity to make the change when it was offered to me? And what would my kids, how would they see me in the future when they learned that I had that opportunity and chose not to take it? How would they see that entity, and would that entity be a service to them and the communities that they're were created to serve if I don't take this opportunity to make those lasting changes? And so sometimes I'll take on responsibilities that don't really benefit me personally, but
overall, it has a lasting impact, right? That's
exactly
the point.
Exactly. And my kids are going to be served for it, and my community will be better served for it. And so sometimes you got to put yourself behind the good of the people. And so
I can agree with that, of course. When I think about the next lesson, interesting, address issues with solutions, not complaints. It kind of fits with what we were just talking about. You can complain about all the things that are wrong, were wrong, but to think in terms of solutions.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times we get into these modes of, like, we come to these meetings and we just want to unload all of our stresses and all of our dissatisfactions.
Yeah.
But that's not really conducive to progress. And so for me, what I try to do is, I start off on that same note. I mean, like, I like to go back and refer to human nature a lot, but I mean, that's one aspect of being human is to find fault in things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I start off on that, but before I express my concerns to other people, I try to have a solution to those things and come to the table to offer some alternatives of what may affect positive change. And so I try to do that in all the things I do, and I try to really think about it in a pros and cons kind of way, and how feasible these changes will be and how they'll affect, like, and see, I mean, even when I'm talking, I can see how all these things kind of play together, because I try to see how it's going to affect the long term, not just my situation, but I want to make something change for the betterment, not just fall into another cycle of another problem.
And it doesn't mean you're not critical. It doesn't mean you say, oh, whatever, everything is fine because I don't want to complain. You want to help create change or adjustments, right? That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, the best way to come to any discussion is to have an idea of and options to move forward. Complaining just keeps you where you're at, if not sets you back, because you create animosity within those environments and within the people that you're trying to work with, and it's not conducive to progress. And so I do complain, but then I offer solutions on how to get past that.
Well, quite fitting. Lesson number 6, don't wait for change. That fits with, well, if you want to effectuate change, if you want to create change, but don't wait for it, how do you make your case if you don't want to, let's say,
part of that change?
Right, exactly.
And that's the thing, like, I have a lot of people I respect a great deal, and I think a lot of them let their emotions and past offenses, I would say, not get in the way or affect, but because I think those past issues should be relevant, but not to the point where it stops the change, you know? And so a lot of people say, well, I'm not working with them because they've done all this and they have a history of this and they've never worked with us in the past. Well, when someone's coming to the table and they want to make those changes and they want to maybe atone for some of those actions in the past and create something that's better, if we're not willing to be part of that discussion or part of that action, then we have no basis to complain anymore. And so I do feel that bringing up past atrocities and past issues is valid, but how do we move forward from those things? And if you're stuck in that mindset that I'm not going to move forward at all because I, no matter what, am so emotional, I don't want to work with you, then it's never going to get better. And so as much as it sucks sometimes to get out of the house and drive across the state to go do something that I'm not getting paid for, you know, like I can see the benefit in it, and you know, and I can see how it directly benefits our people and the greater communities, and it makes me feel good that I can say that I'm part of something that has an impact like that. And
sure,
and that, to me, that's the reward is doing that. And you know, I don't think on a personal level I'm as selfless as my dad, but I think the only reason I'm even into all this stuff and I want to help are those lessons that they've given me. And so who knows, maybe in another 10 years, I'll have some more truths.
I'm kind of curious, Jacob, when I think about Native American culture, compare it to whatever we call it, suburban culture, the differences are clear. The difference in history is clear. In the state of Arizona, where you and I are living, I believe there are 21 tribes living here in Arizona. There is, of course, massive history over hundreds, again, thousands of years. And certain tribes were perhaps a little bit more aggressive. Do you look at other tribes as, well, this particular tribe, they fought my ancestors and I have not forgotten? Or do you look at it perhaps to say, whatever happened, we are as Native American tribes here in Arizona, we are all on the same level. We all agree with one another.
You're right. There are many tribes here, and we're all distinct in individual communities with their own languages and their own belief systems. And even within the Otham communities, we have dialectual differences and variations on our stories. And is it true that we fought with a lot of people, or that a lot of people warred with us? Yes. And so the go-to tribe that everybody relates to our enemy would be the Ob or the Apache. And now that word Ob has come to mean the enemy. But at one time, that word didn't mean the enemy.
Oh,
that
really?
Word just, I didn't know that. Yeah, that name was just attributed to other people. And so the Apaches were known as the Ob, or the Inde were known as the Ob, as most Apaches call themselves. And there's historic accounts or oral traditions that say that we did get along with them, that we traded with them, that we visited with them. And then there was times of war and bad times and hardships. And really, you know, when the Spanish came into this area, that was probably one of those times where there was some bad blood between the people. As history goes, it's the story of the victor or whoever's writing that story. And so that's an American history's point of view or viewpoint on the relationships amongst tribes. And so today, yes, there's even like some of our leadership that I've heard, you know, say disparaging things about other Apache tribes and lists documented accounts of wars or battles that we've had with them. And even some of the different human tribes that we share a reservation with, there's like jokes that we tease each other about. But I think now today it's vital that we come together, that we unify. I don't think all of our viewpoints are the same because we're distinct and we have different beliefs.
We're kind of stepping into lesson number 7, right? Address conflict analytically to find common ground.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, it's true. You had to put some of those things down, you know, some of those emotional differences in those historic events that impacted our communities negatively from one another, you know, happened. and they can be observed. But how do we move past that to make a better future? And I think that's more important. And how do we not only acknowledge those times, but the good times, because there were. And I think when you're telling a story, the juicy bits are what people cling to, and then that's what passes down, you know, in time. And so that's what we learn in school. But if we look back at our own stories and the knowledge that we passed down, you know, there were those times. And then, as I used to do consultation for the tribe as well, for a government-to-government consultation for Section 106, and it's the precursor to NAGPRA, Native American Graves Repatriation. Oh, Protection and Repatriation Act. And so it's the law that says that nobody has the right to own the remains of our ancestors or the items of cultural patrimony that exists for the continuance of our cultural practices. And so the consultation that I did was the precursor to those laws and that position. And I think a lot of times when we would go to meetings, there was at times maybe not from our staff, because I think our staff viewed it a little differently, but there was at times an us versus them kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to come and this is what we want out of this meeting. And then the other counterparts, they have an idea of what they want from the meeting. And that already sets up a atmosphere for clash, you know? And so, and a lot of times it's based on emotion. It's based on what I want to get out of this, because of all, and from our side, it would be from all the atrocities that have been done to my people for all this time. I'm not going to budge at all. This is what I want, and this is what you're going to give me, you know? And, but to me, like I said, it's not conducive to lasting change, and it's not conducive to getting somebody to hear your point of view. And so I really like to really weigh out those things and think of the impacts and what I'm requesting and what they're asking and how that affects the outcome. And is it something that we're fighting for that's of no value really, but just to win? Or
we need more people like you who think like you, I would say, around the world, to try to find common ground and understand that not everybody is in agreement. That's not the point. That's not a fair goal to aim for, but to find common ground and obviously to do it in a peaceful manner. That would be the way to a solution.
And I think when you start to get emotional, then your train of thought is impacted, and your analytical thinking or your logical thinking is kind of out the door. And so it becomes a fight, and I don't really see that conducive to success. And so I try not to do that. And I try to play the devil's advocate as well and see like other points of view. And I really like to debate, and a lot of people say, oh, you like to argue. Well, I like to debate, you know.
Yeah,
and
that's,
I think,
healthy.
You know, and I think if you're doing it in a civil manner, and if you can state your argument or your position on something, if you know what you're talking about and you can relay it in a good way, I think that impacts other people, and I think they can see your point of view, but also be willing to see their point of view and see their truths as well, and see where they may be right and you may be wrong, you know, and be able to be okay with those things. And I think that's how you really like find the truth or something that's a stronger opinion.
I think you make a very good point. I also believe as an immigrant that we have to learn more about the Native American cultures in a way. I almost want to say we take it for granted, but we really, many people don't really know the true history, the true cultural elements, and the differences between various tribes and Native Americans, as if it's all the same, and it's not. It's almost like different countries. It is something that I think many people need to learn more about Native American cultures.
We're truly a nations within a nation, you know.
Exactly. And that's, I think, it's very positive to learn more and to understand more, definitely. Now, lesson number 8, don't let fear limit what you can do. There are limitations as far as what you can do, and sometimes it's based on fear. The danger of not succeeding, or the danger that you cross a line and perhaps upset people, if not offend people. But what are your thoughts about that?
So basically what it says, like, don't let fear, you know, limit what you can do. And I guess what I'm saying is, if I were to say no to everything that I was scared of, I probably wouldn't be in the position that I'm in now. And I wouldn't have learned half of the things that I've learned, you know. And so anytime you get into something new, there's a fear there. It's foreign, you know, it's yeah. something that's not known to you. It's uncomfortable. And so you're scared. And for me, really what I'm saying is when an opportunity comes, take advantage of it, whether you've done it before or not. Believe in yourself. Again, know your worth, believe in yourself. So an example, the first time that I went on travel for my work was to Wisconsin, and they asked me to do a presentation after the conference that I had attended. They said it was to our high school. And so I said, yeah, I'll stay a little later. I got permission. And I think I was about 24, 23. And it ended up being not only their entire school district, but the community at large. And so there was, I believe, like 1,600 people there in this big auditorium. Wow. And it was just me. And so as a young adult, I was very antisocial. And that was my first kind of trial by fire to be able to present in front of large crowds and things like that. And it came comfortable to me because I knew what I was talking about. And I was confident in what I was saying. And I think when I did the NMAI Artist Leadership Grant, what was really, I guess, directly related to what I was saying here is a friend of mine had taken me on travel with him to his leadership grant the year before. And I said, you know, I can do a lot of this stuff. I study these shells, and I would love to have the opportunity to come back. And the person that was in charge of that program, his name was Kevin Lewis. And he said, you know, well, like Nike says, just do it. And he said, have you ever wrote a grant? I said, no, I don't know the first thing about writing a grant. And he said, well, just do it. You never know. And we came home and I didn't think anything of it. And then there was a 1 week deadline before it was brought up again. And my friend said, hey, did you write that grant? Did you apply? And I said, no. And he's like, why? I told him, because I've never done that before and I don't want to fail. And he said, well, just do it. Like Kevin said, just try. And so I wrote that grant, I think after some edging from my wife, 2 days before it was due, I submitted it on the final hour. And it was the first grant that it was ever approved. And since then, I've written a couple more and I've achieved them. But yeah, I never knew how to write grants until I tried. And I've learned how to do them a little better. I never knew how to make silver jewelry until I tried. And actually, these ones here are the first post earrings that I've ever done. And it was because somebody asked me to.
They look beautiful. Said, well, they look absolutely thank beautiful. You. Yeah.
But I think when you let fear limit your potential, then you'll never really understand or realize who you can become. And I've taken my pottery skills to shell to silver. I've worked on hotels. I've designed the outside of hotels. I've worked on historic buildings that are on the National Historic Registry. I've actually painted murals with a friend of mine at a national monument. Actually, the country's first national monument is Casa Grande Ruins. And we painted murals within their visitor center. And we actually starred small roles in their visitor orientation film. And so those are things I've never done before, but I didn't let that stop me. And has there been times that I failed? Yes. And is there going to be failure in your life? Definitely. But you shouldn't let that stop you from trying. At least try.
You really have come a long ways, and a lot because of your artistic talent. It's impressive. And obviously, we'll see what will come next. I think that's that's always the big question. And at the same time, you're on that track. And I think it's powerful. It truly is powerful. Lesson number 9, follow through, but know when to ask for help. Again, you're doing well, everything is going well, and you're expanding your scope, your artwork. You do different types of artwork in addition to what you used to do. But when to ask for help? How do you determine that you need to ask help? Because you can do it all.
When I exhaust every other possibility, I hate asking for help, but I identify that as an issue of mine, and it's something that I work on. And so I really do hate asking for help. I try to find all the information out on my own. And I know I'm more of a private person in my own life. And I know how I feel when people come to ask for help. I usually do it, but I gripe about it to my wife and to my kids sometimes, you know? And so, I try not to, but you get to a point where you have to realize either you're going to succeed or fail by being stubborn, you know, and if you want to be stubborn and you don't want to really ask for the help that you know you need, then you're not only going to fail yourself, but you're going to let people down. And so there's been times that I've worked on stuff and it was the first time and I had to go out and find someone to help me, you know, and what's really cool is their willingness to help me. And I think that was based on our relationships and the things that we had shared in the past. And like, the same thing with all these different things. Like I've worked on these hotels and national monuments and things like that. And like you said, one fell into the other. And it was based on these relationships that we had with the city, or I had with the city, or certain groups. And through working with them, they knew me and they're like, well, this is a really good guy. He's always helped us out. Well, let's offer this to him. Let's see if he's able to do this. It's kind of that karma, you know, like what you put out in the world comes back to you. And so I always try to give my help. Sometimes I'm not always happy about doing it, and I'll gripe on my own to myself, but I do. And I try to help when I can. And it's come back to me.
Well, that's interesting. And as you mentioned earlier, and you referred to your father, but I know you do the same. When people ask for your help, you're ready to step in. You're ready to live up. You've given several examples of that. And it may be, I don't know whether it is, you know, a form of humility that perhaps, and I think we all have that to a certain extent, it may be difficult to ask for help, but to offer help, there's no reluctance. That's what you do automatically because you want to help. And at the same time, asking for help sometimes is difficult, but you have to figure out, like you said, that moment that you say, yes, you have to come up with that moment for yourself to say, at this point, I need to have some assistance.
Yeah. And for me, like my dad, he when people ask him for help, he just gets up and does it. He doesn't gripe. He's happy to do it. And he's cracking jokes all the time. And I think that's something I'm dealing with right now. Like, I'll gripe and I'll crack jokes and I'll play down on it. But I still complain. And that's not really how I was taught. But also, I was also taught that you shouldn't have to ask for help. And you shouldn't offer your help. You should give it. And so if somebody needs to sit down, then get up and give them your chair. If they're hungry, you feed them. You don't ask them if they're hungry, because that puts the ownership on them to ask for that food.
Yeah.
And so if somebody says, you know, hey, would you like to eat? I'm going to be polite and say, oh, no, I'm okay. But if someone were to put a plate in my hand and say, here you go, here, sit down and eat with us, then I'm going to accept that as a gift and respect the person that gave it to me and eat it. The same thing about giving up a seat. I'm going to respect the person that offered it to me, even though I really appreciate it. It's I guess it's a traditional custom, because you don't require that acknowledgement of needing help.
Lesson number 10, I find it quite powerful. The greatest change I can affect is my own.
Yeah, a friend of mine told me that a long time ago, and I was like, oh, that just sounds stupid. No, but I was like, well, how is just changing my way of living any different? Like, how is that going to do? How is that going to make an impact?
And you say it's the greatest change, right? It's not just a change. The greatest change I can affect is my own.
I didn't really believe that, but after 20 years of following things that I believe in, what's fundamental to me, those fundamental values that are important to me, I focused my work on these things, you know, and through my actions, I was really only working on my own, myself. Mm-hmm. And then I was placed into positions because of the work that I was doing on my own for myself. And then through my actions, other people came and asked, or I was able to teach. And then I'd like to say too, like, I freely offer my help, but I don't force it upon anybody. And so even at work, which is a little different, I don't say, well, this is how you're supposed to do something. I wait till somebody asks. And when they want my opinion, then I share it. And I always share it in a way that's respectful as well, because even within our own community, family circles teach things a little differently, and communities vary even greater. And so the way I like to say is this is how I was taught, or how I know it, or how I was brought up. This is what I learned. And then I share those things. And I also make the distinction to say that those may be different if you're from a different community or a different family. But so an example here is this garden program that we started was started in 98, and it was started at the school here, and then that stopped. And then in 2004, it started again. And at the time, farming was not something that was conducive to success here in the community. It's not something that anybody cared about, and nobody really wanted to do it. And we're a farming community. We're an agricultural society. Well, today, it's a lot different. there's gardening components in a lot of different programs. And when we sat with council a couple of years ago, at the request of our youth council that wanted to know, why don't we farm anymore? Why can't we eat the foods that we've grown for thousands of years? Yeah. You say to return to a traditional diet, but it's no longer here. So why aren't we doing that as a tribe?
Yeah.
And so the voices of our youth that came through our programs went to our leadership and said, why don't we have these? And they actually developed a farming feasibility study because of their desire. And so there's been a big change. And when we were sitting there talking with them, they said, well, did you work with the Boys and Girls Club and see how they're doing their garden program? Or did you work with the food bank and ask them how they did their program? What about the high school? And they named a bunch of other programs within the tribe departments that have their own gardening components. Even our juvenile detention center and our adult detention centers have gardens. And one of the things that really touched me, it truly impacted me personally, was that I had the opportunity to say, we helped develop those. We started that. Every time they asked us about a program that exists here, we started that. We planted that seed with them. We set up their gardens. We gave them the insight. We built those programs. And so when we were done with those meetings, my director said, you know what? It's easy to kind of downplay the impact that you guys have, because you're just the gardeners and you guys go out and you garden over there and nobody really sees a lot of the work. But he said, when the council asked you about 10 different programs, you're the one that started them all. And so it was a really cool day for me, but more so I can see the change that's in our people. When I drive home, I can see the gardens that are in their yards because of the programs that we had here. And so now gardening and hopefully agriculture on a larger scale isn't just something to be respected as a cultural heritage. It's something that we can actually get into and that there's support behind from the people. And eating these foods is one thing, and it helps to curb the onset of diabetes, heart disease, and obesity, but there's something to be said about actually doing the work. That's mm-hmm. a big component of it. And so to see this younger generation that's going to be the future leaders of our community really vested in some of this work is powerful. And it shows that the impact that we make can be greater than yourself. And so through that change that I made in myself, you know, I can see it in our community now. So I believe that.
It's impressive. Again, what you just mentioned as far as the community garden and your involvement with that. And as we discussed earlier, of course, you are a highly respected and successful artist. I want to ask you one more question, put you on the spot here. If you think about lessons learned, is there perhaps a lesson that you have unlearned in your life? Anything that you used to do and you were happy and convinced it was the right thing, and you came to a point where you said, you know what, I need to do things differently. Have you had a moment like that?
Yeah, I don't know, I touched on it earlier. I said, you know, I was very antisocial as a kid, and for all the work that my mom and dad, you know, invested in me and all the time that they spent, I was in Boy Scouts and baseball and all these other different like extracurricular activities. And we were like the first Boy Scout troop in any reservation in the United States. And my dad had a hand in that. And for all that effort, I was still a really bad kid. And, you know, I did a lot of bad things as a kid. And where I went to school was in the city. And at the time that I went to school was in the 90s, really. And in the 80s and 90s in Phoenix, it was a dangerous time to be here. And it was very much segregated or separated by our own doing. And so when you went to school, you seen these little groups of all the Native kids. And then you see all the little groups of like the churchgoers, like the LDS community, and then the Chicanos, and then not just the Chicanos, but the Mexicans that are of Mexican descent that are from Mexico. They would hang out with each other, and then the Black students would hang out with each other, and then the white students would hang out with each other, and they would all separate themselves.
Yeah.
And at the time, there was a big skinhead group that I went to school with. And so we clashed a lot and I got in a lot of trouble fighting with them. And so for me, I was very antisocial. I only hung out with my own people from the res that I knew and people that I grew up with. And I had a lot of hate in my heart. And I had a lot of hate towards people that I didn't even know because of the things that were done to me by people that looked like them.
Yeah.
And didn't have anything to do with the people that I was meeting later in life. It was done by specific people at a specific time, but I carried that with me. And then I went to school and I learned all the atrocities that happened to Native Americans in general, you know, and things that I didn't learn in high school or junior high. And then it kind of developed that anger in me. But I think traveling as an adult, meeting different people and really being able to see past some of those things and know somebody on a personal level really helped me overcome a lot of that. And I don't think I would be the same person that I am today if I would have stuck to some of that and kept that hate in my heart and being able to let go of that and really fall back on these traditional teachings of acceptance and helping not just our own people, but everybody, because we all are the same, you know, and those differences is what makes it special. And so I think that's what I've learned is to be more accepting and to let go of this hate for things that I can't just throw on a whole group of people for no reason.
What an incredible journey. And like you said, we're confronted by various mixed messages, many of them quite negative. And you managed to grow out of that, learn by experiencing people, places, having an open mind. I think this is a great lesson of wisdom that you're sharing with me, with our audience. And I want to thank you for your participation in this podcast.
Well, thank you. And before we go, though, I would like to mention one other thing, because I give a lot of credit to my dad, but my mom was a big factor in my life as well. And so I can remember a time that she taught me how to stand up for myself and to know my value. And one big lesson in life was in high school, well, actually junior high. It was our first day of school. And our teacher said, I want everybody that's from the reservation to raise their hand. And so we all raised our hand. I was in English. And he said, I want you to stay after and I'll give you a note so that you're not counted late for your next class. But you need to stay after so I can talk to you. So we all did. And he said, you know, all of you guys are from the reservation. I'm going to tell you right now, I have no respect for you. You guys are trouble.
Wow.
Your people have always made trouble in my class. You're never going to succeed in life. You're never going to amount to anything. So just sit in the back, don't talk, and don't waste anybody else's time because my students are here to learn. I was pissed off, right? And so I went home and I was mad and I was like, man, I don't want to go back to school. This is the first day of school.
Yeah.
And
wow.
So my mom, she's like, well, what's going on? So I told her. The first thing in the morning, she marched us down to the principal's office and demanded that teacher come in there, and she chewed him out. And she didn't just require him to apologize to me, but to all those kids. And I don't know, it's weird, like I usually don't get emotional, but like it was something that really like resonated with me. And
that's a big moment. That's I can understand. To be addressed, first of all, in that manner, I mean, that is, I want to say, the definition of discrimination, right? Mm. To be treated like that. And then for your mom, I happen to know your mom, for your mom to step up and go out there and set things straight, and I hope with a positive effect, was the teacher or the principal, were they open to that? Were they...
The teacher or the principal first tried to downplay everything, and then the teacher followed suit, and the principal was really protecting his staff, and my mom wouldn't stand for it. She was like, no, you guys are going to make it right. And I don't know, that's something that like to this day I can remember clearly, and it's something that's always resonated with me. And my mom's been like a big advocate for me, even even with all the trouble I've given her and put her through, like, she's always came to my side, and she's a big advocate for me. And so when my dad is like this ultra giver, my mom is this really steadfast force behind me that's really there, like, to support and fight. And that taught me a lot. And so I always stand up for the things that I believe in. And I think that's where I get it, is I know my value, and your opinion of me doesn't really affect my own worth of myself.
Thank you, Jacob, for joining us. You have been listening to the international podcast of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, produced by Robert Hossery and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, and parties. For more information, please visit professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Thank you, and stay safe.